Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Many of you remember that question. You were perhaps 10 or 12 or 15 years of age, and you walked down an aisle, perhaps in a church building, and you stood before a group of people, and they asked you that very question. With all of your heart, do you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Have you ever considered the importance, the significance of that question? You ever thought that how you answer that question determines the very course of your life? If Jesus is not the Son of God, then all that we do is folly. The morals that we have decided to live our lives upon, the directions we've decided to take in life, this very meeting together that we call times of worship and times of service, they're meaningless if Jesus is not the Son of God. But if He is the Son of God, then it matters greatly how we live. If He is the Son of God, it matters greatly what this book says. So our relationship with Jesus, there must be a faith that looks at the evidence that claims that Jesus is God's Son and that determines that we will believe that Jesus is the Son of God. You see, Jesus Himself said, "If you do not believe that I am He, you will die in your sins." But what difference does it matter if we believe that He's He if He is not the Son of God? His statement is of no real value. But if He is the Son of God, then it changes the course of your life. You see, who says I must believe in Him also says I must confess that He's God's Son. And why make that confession? You know, here's water, He said. What hinders me from being baptized? If you believe, you may. You see, why make that confession, that good confession, if He is not the Son of God? Have you ever thought how strange it would look for some foreigner, some outsider who's never attended a service like this to come in and see some mature individual taken and buried underwater and brought back from out from under that water and raised, as we say, to newness of life? What on earth is the meaning of this? And I'm telling you, it really has no meaning at all unless Jesus is the Son of God. But why do you believe that He's God's Son? What made you decide to believe it? Well, maybe you say my mom and dad, but didn't they tell you about the Easter Bunny and the Tooth Fairy as well? And you know how that turned out. Is He the Son of God or not? And if He is the Son of God, then the He who He describes with His own mouth, He who believes and is baptized shall be saved, that is the He that will be saved. So I ask you, do you believe He's God's Son? What kind of evidence would it take? How much evidence would it take? Have you ever thought deeply about what you base your belief upon? What evidence would it take for you to consider and say, I believe He's the Son of God? Well, in the book of John, chapter 20, John says, I've written down enough in this one book, the book of John, enough to convince you that He's the Son of God, enough to cause you to believe that He's the Son of God. John says there's more, but much, much more. In fact, a chapter later he'll say that there's so much more written, could have been written. If all that He had done had been written, I suppose he says that the world couldn't even contain the books. He said, I wrote down in this book enough to convince those who have not seen these things that He was the Son of God. So let's do something tonight. Tonight, could I borrow your brain? Could I use your imagination for just a few moments? Could we, by the eye of faith, go back and imagine that we were there when John wrote about the very events he wrote about? For you see, there is no doubt that Jesus is an historical character. And there is no doubt that the people who were there were real people that saw these things happen. So can we go back in our minds to pretend tonight that we were there when these events occurred in the first century? Can I draw pictures with your mind in such a way to help you see and imagine that you were there as it's happening? Scene 1. John chapter 1. In fact, open your Bibles to the book of John. We'll walk through that book this evening. John chapter 1. Or 2, excuse me. Imagine this evening that you were living in the first century and that the job that you have is you have been hired as a servant of a wedding feast. You've been working at this wedding feast, I don't know how long, much, much, much longer than weddings that will occur some 20, 21 centuries later. But it's been your responsibility to make sure that the water that is there is evenly distributed. It's not your job to make sure there's wine there, but to make sure that the wine that is there is distributed correctly. And all of a sudden something happens. You notice something. And you realize, we're going to run out of wine. And so the governor of the feast is notified and all sorts of problems develop in your life. And then the most amazing thing happens. The most life-changing thing that will ever happen in your life happens when this man walks up. You see, he's just a guest at the wedding feast. But his mother's brought him. His mother says with some degree of authority, enough to convince you, whatever he says do, do it. And he tells you, see those water pots over there? Fill them up with water. And you do. And with whatever vessel you have, you dip down into those big vats of water and you pour the water, you carry it from one location to another and you fill up that first vessel and that second vessel and again and again and again until you've carried 180 gallons of water, nearly 1,500 pounds of water. And then all of a sudden this man, with your back aching and your reputation on the line, says, now take some of it out. And with your own hands you dip down into one of those huge containers and you pull out some of the water that you've just put in and the water is no longer water. You smell the aroma before you taste it. And before your own eyes, the water has been changed. The answer. But you search deep within your mind to try to get a grasp of what just happened in front of you. You know better than anyone there wasn't any more wine left. If there had been more wine, if the neighbors had wine, you would have gone and gotten it. You carried the water. And it's been turned into wine. And when it's tasted, it's the best wine. Better than it's any that's been served. And you don't even know his name. But immediately that becomes job one. And this name is etched deeply within your brain. Jesus of Nazareth. Scene 2, John chapter 4. Not many days pass, and you hear that he's back in your city, Cana of Galilee, where you lived. And you would have done it, wouldn't you have? You would have gone to see what was going to happen. I mean, he's back in town and you hear about it, and so you go just to see what he might do this time. And from some distance away, a nobleman comes running, a man of authority. And you know that men of authority did not run in that culture. That was a sign of their authority. They didn't have to run. People ran to them, but they didn't run to people. But this one's running, and he's impassioned, and he's crying out, come quickly, my son is sick, come quickly, lest he die. Perhaps you as a father or mother or a grandparent or as a child have had someone you loved or someone who loved you, and you understand the cry of that father. What it's like to have a child that's sick and you hear the pain in his voice, come quickly, he's going to die. And you know what this man does? He says, go, your son's been made whole. Well, some distance over to Capernaum, but you follow the nobleman back home because you want to see what happened. And before he even gets home, his servants come running out and they say, your son was made whole. When did it happen? Yesterday about 1 p.m. And you remember that that's the very hour that this man Jesus of Nazareth had said, your son is made whole. Who is this man Jesus? Who is he? John chapter 5. You have a friend. He's crippled. He's been crippled for 38 years. And while you live up in Cana, he lives down in Jerusalem, and you've helped carry that friend to this porch around Bethsaida, one of the porches at the temple, because there's this unusual belief that an angel will come down and touch the water, and the water will stir, and whoever gets in that water first after the supposed angel touched it, they're healed of whatever. And so around that temple pool, there are lame people and blind people and deaf people and people with all sorts of sicknesses. And your friend is there that day. You know because you carried him. And you happened to be there when Jesus walks up to your friend who hasn't walked in 38 years. And he says, "Arise, take up your bed and walk." And before your very eyes, your friend walks. Who is he? I think you would have done it. You start following him. I mean, how important is your job at this point? This man is a man of God. You go everywhere he goes. You want to be around a man like him. Never a man speak like this man. And you listen and you marvel because he doesn't speak like the scribes and Pharisees, but he speaks as one with authority. That same voice of authority that said, "Fill up those water pots." That same voice of authority that said to your crippled friend, "Take up your bed and walk," is the same voice that says, you've heard that it said by them of old time, but I tell you, a new kingdom's coming. A new way is coming. I say to you, my Father has sent me. Scene 4. John chapter 6. You follow him for days, hanging on every unique word. This time you're in Galilee. You realize that before the announcement's made, you're getting hungry. You didn't realize how late it would get, and you don't have any food. There are 5,000 men, not counting the women and children, that many and more, 10,000, 15,000. But we know for sure 5,000 men were there. They're like you, listening, hanging on every word this man says. You hear him as he says, calls them to sit down in groups of hundreds and fifties. And you see him as he takes the food that one boy has, and before your own eyes he blesses it and he breaks the bread and the fish. And you don't know how, but it doesn't run out. He keeps giving it and giving it and giving it until 5,000, 10,000, 15,000 people are full and so satisfied. And you hear him as he says to his disciples standing around, "Cause that nothing be wasted. Take up what's left over," and 12 baskets full are left. Who is this man? Who is this Jesus? Scene 5. Still in John 6, around verse 23. Night begins to fall. Jesus goes up in the mountains. The disciples get in a boat. You remember that night, not so much as it's happening, but you remember it the next day. Because the next day when you look for Jesus, he's not there. He's on the other side with his disciples. But he didn't get in the boat. His disciples are there. But Jesus never got in that boat. Well, by this time you know Simon Bar-Jonah, son of Jonah. You knew Levi. You paid your taxes to him. They're your friends, the sons of Zebedee, James and John. So you go to one of them and ask, "How did Jesus get here?" And they tell you of what happened that night. They tell you of being out on Galilee, some 3 or 4 miles out. And that storm that came up. And you remember that storm, not because you were in the boat, but because you were on the seashore and you saw that storm as it developed. And you know about the storms and how they developed on Galilee. You remember the wind and the tempestuous storm. And they said it scared us to death. We thought the boat was going to capsize. But then off in the distance, Peter saw him first. And he said, "There's a ghost coming." But as he got closer, he hollered out, "Be of good cheer. Don't be afraid." And Jesus walked on the water. But then he got in the boat. And more impressively than even walking on the water, he shouted out into that black, dark, billowy sea, "Peace, be still." And that raging, billowy sea suddenly became the glassy Sea of Galilee. Who is this man, Jesus? Scene 7, John chapter 9. Your other friend, the blind one, he was born that way. There's been a lot of discussion about why he's blind. Some have said he sinned, but he was born that way, so how is that possible? Others say his parents committed some sin, and so that's how it happened. But regardless, he's blind. And your friend Jesus is in Jerusalem again, and you are there. And your blind friend is in the presence of Jesus. And you see this man, Jesus of Nazareth, as he spits on the ground, and with the spitting, the clay makes the substance, and He covers your friend's eyes and He says, go and wash in the pool of Siloam. You know where that pool is. You pass it often. So you take your friend by the hand, your blind friend, and you lead him to that pool. And he does as Jesus said. He steps down in that pool and he anoints his eyes. He splashes water up on his eyes and the scales, something like scales, are removed and the chills precede the tears. As your friend begins to shout, I can see, I can see, I can see again. Your friend is not blind anymore. Who is this man? Scene 8. John 11. Then it happens over in Bethany. One of his headquarters. That close family, Mary and Martha, sisters and their brother, Lazarus. Lazarus is dead. They're friends of yours. You go immediately. You help bind up his body. You help carry that lifeless body. And you help put that lifeless body in the cave-like tomb. And you and several others are involved in rolling that heavy stone to seal off that grave. What do you say at a time like this? It's very probably that when this man Jesus arrives, that Mary and Martha say word for word what everybody else there had already been thinking. If Jesus had been here, my brother wouldn't have died. And you've seen enough by now to think, yeah, that's probably the truth. And word comes, Jesus has arrived. The Master's come, He's calling for you. And first one sister and then the other rush out. And to their identical comments, Jesus simply says, where have you laid him? Where's the body? Don't roll back that stone. It's morbid to unbury the dead. It's thoughtless, it's gross, it's cruel. He stinks by now. But He says in that voice, roll back the stone and you'll never forget it. Even to this day, the thought of it causes little hairs on the back of your neck to stand up. As He steps to that black tomb-like cave and He shouts into it, Lazarus, come forth. The great evangelist Marshall Keble said he cried out, Lazarus, come forth, because he just cried out, come forth. Everybody that ever died would have come out of the grave. And you look back. Your eyes adjust to the darkness. And you see movement. And dead Lazarus walks out. Who is this man, Jesus? But then it all begins to unravel. They trump up charges against him. They lie. They arrest him. They nail him to a cross. And you see as another body is taken down. And you see as another tomb is closed. As another stone is rolled. John chapter 20. God wants you to believe that those women on that resurrection morning that went to the tomb that Sunday, that a heavenly being was standing at that grave. And that being said, He is not here. He's risen. You didn't see it. Neither did I. But I ask you right now, do you believe with all your heart that He who turned the water into wine, cured your crippled friend, raised your friend's daughter, multiplied the loaves and fishes, walked in the water and stilled the storm. Do you believe that He who opened the eyes of the blind and raised the dead? Do you believe that God raised Him from the dead? Do you believe with all your heart that Jesus is the Son of God? And do you believe that that tomb was not opened so that he might get out, so that men could see in that he was not there. Do you believe that while he beheld, while they beheld, he was taken out of their sight? Do you believe that being stood with those 11 and said, this same Jesus whom you've seen ascend into heaven will come in like manner as you've seen him go? Do you believe that he will come again with all his holy angels, taking to be with God those who have lived for him, and taking vengeance on those who have not? Do you believe it? Do you believe that Jesus is the Son of God? And do you believe that all he asks you to do is to make a decision, to turn from the sin that's corrupted this whole world and that's messed up your life as well, and to turn to a better life, a life lived for him? Do you believe that with the mouth, confession is made into salvation? And do you believe that when one is buried in baptism, he is raised to walk a new life? Do you believe with all of your heart that Jesus is the Son of God? Church, might I speak to you? If you believe it, does it show in this community? Do your friends know you believe it? By the way you live, do they see that you're a believer? By the way you react to the circumstances of life, by the words that you live and the decisions that you make, does it show the confession you made? I believe Jesus is the Son of God. Do you believe with all your heart that Jesus is the Son of God? Do you believe that Jesus is tenderly calling? And if you do, will you come and stand with us as we stand and sing?